Syrians toppled a dictator. Today they have a new leader.
He's managed to rehabilitate Syria as a state, managed to gain international recognition for his government.
That is on the world stage.
Domestically, the scorecard is pretty low.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, how Syria's reinvention is going 1 year in. Also, investigating toxic waste in a town where it is hard to miss.
The closer I get, the stronger this smell of fetid onions or manure or sewage.
Plus, Colombian mercenaries are fighting around the globe.
Colombians had the profile to fit those positions that were lacking.
That's all ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for being here. Conflicts happening in one part of the world have ripple effects all over. Just one example today, the war in Sudan. Colombians are doing some of the fighting there. This week, the U.S. announced sanctions against those responsible for hiring out Colombian mercenaries to the Rapid Support Forces, a rebel group in Sudan. The RSF has been accused of war crimes, including genocide. There is some history to Colombian soldiers turning up in other conflict zones. Crisis Group's Elizabeth Dickinson is based in Bogota. She explained why Colombian mercenaries are in global demand.
So Colombia has a very specific military history. This is a country that has been involved in internal conflict for over a half century, which means that everyone in the military, from the sort of rank and file soldiers to the mid-level officers to the generals, have been actively involved in operations every day of their life in the military, every day of their career. That means that they have a lot of tactical and operational experience that is really coveted in conflicts that are kinetic and active, like Sudan, like Ukraine, like Yemen. Colombians first started going to these roles precisely because there were these gaps. And I think Colombians had the profile to fit those positions that were lacking for private security contractors.
So you mentioned Ukraine, Sudan, obviously, Yemen, where Colombians are fighting. Is there a sense of how many Colombians are serving as mercenaries around the world right now?
So we don't have a good number. What I can tell you is that I think this system, from its inception, and I can say that my personal interaction with this world dates back at least 15 years, when Colombians were first recruited to help build armies, for example, in the United Arab Emirates, which was looking to construct a military from scratch and contracted Colombians precisely for that experience and that expertise on U.S. weapons systems. I think since then, what has happened, frankly, is that the industry has spiraled a little bit out of control. And the level of due diligence and also oversight on what's happening has not kept up with the pace of recruitment. So we have, of course, some companies that are doing the right due diligence and are contracting legally. We also, frankly, have a lot of gray spaces where we have private military contractors offering contracts to Colombians without those key details about what they'll be doing, even where they will be based, and then taking these individuals into situations that are, in many cases, compromising the human rights of those involved, but also of people on the ground and civilians, which has clearly been the case in Sudan.
So tell me more about these companies that are recruiting these fighters. Are they based in Colombia? Are they based in the countries that need additional fighters? And kind of how do they work?
The one that was sanctioned particularly was run by a former colonel from the Colombian military who set up an operation in Dubai some years ago and essentially had the connections within the Colombian military to bring some of the best officers that he had worked with into this business. That element of a personal connection is really clear because you can think about this market a little bit like migration. It works through word of mouth.
Okay. There's no job postings on ZipRecruiter for mercenary.
Well, precisely. So if my friend has gone to Ukraine and earned $10,000 a month and then been able to retire comfortably, well, maybe I should do that. And maybe he can give me the connection. We've seen recruitment posts circulated on WhatsApp among active duty fighter here. And that's essentially, you know, how this is spreading through this idea of hope, the idea of an easy retirement, a way to sort of finally earn the salary that, you know, they feel they deserved after many years fighting in literally in the trenches here in Colombia. So, you know, again, I think these companies prey on that sort of hope. And frankly, they prey on the poor conditions of retired military officers here in Colombia, whose pensions probably amount to several hundred dollars a month, depending on the rank at retirement. Access to healthcare is at times very problematic. And so these are individuals who need to find work. And this industry has begun to prey on those individuals in order to construct this mercenary business.
So how meaningful are these sanctions?
I think here it's very important that they are targeting, again, the organizers of the business. What we hear from Colombians who have had this experience abroad is that they're often given contracts that aren't totally clear. Some of them aren't even told where they're going. And I think that the sort of myth around this industry as a golden parachute for Colombian military, a way to earn money in retirement, has led some people to not ask the due diligence questions that they would normally. And so they've ended up in situations that are obviously very much in counter to their own interests, but also those of peace and security more broadly.
And so what is the reality that they are facing when they go? You mentioned sometimes they don't even know which countries they're deploying to or the nature of the work is misrepresented.
There's a dramatic variation. And I think it is important to say that some of these individuals are contracted legally and they work the same way that any private defense company works. So there is that space. And there is a part of this business that does have good controls. However, there is too much of the business that, as you said, has sort of misled, I think, those who are contracted into situations they don't have control of. For example, we know of cases in which Colombians are recruited and sent on multiple planes in which they're not being told where they're going until the last plane has landed. They sort of open the military plane door and find themselves to be in Libya, in Sudan, without a clear understanding of what the conflict is, of which party they're fighting on behalf of, what the conditions are for civilians, or even, you know, what is being expected of them.
What is the impact in Colombia of so much of the population being pulled into conflicts around the world?
It has really raised a lot of alarm bells in Colombia. And there's actually a legislative project at the moment to put some restrictions on this industry. Because first of all, it's a liability for Colombia to have its former military personnel seen to be acting on behalf of parties to conflict that are, first of all, committing crimes in the context of the laws of war, but also maybe against sort of the interests of the Colombian state itself. So I think this is the first concern, is the political concern. There is also a lot of concern, frankly, about Colombians being victimized in this situation, again, being sent into situations without the conditions and without understanding what they're getting themselves into. And, you know, I think there's also some real questions to be asked here in Colombia about why this is happening. And I think here the real answer is that the conditions and services and sort of retirement packages for individuals who have devoted dozens of years to fighting on behalf of Colombia simply aren't good enough to prevent this sort of market from preying on military personnel. It's a good moment to ask those questions. You know, how could we improve the retirement situation of these individuals? In Colombia, you can retire after 20 years of active service in the military. If you join at 18, we're talking about a retirement at 38, when you still probably have young children, need to be generating income well beyond what a pension could offer. And that is the space, again, these private defense companies are entering.
Very basic question for you. If these companies do things by the books and their fighters are not involved in, you know, suspected war crimes, this whole thing is legal.
In many cases, yes. And, you know, I think here it's worth thinking about private security companies that all around the world that stand guard, for example, against infrastructure facilities, you know, the guard outside of a supermarket. I mean, there is a way to do the private security industry legally. The problem in this case is that we're talking about extremely volatile and politically sensitive situations in which the actors involved are not subject to the level of controls and due diligence that they would need to be for this to be legal.
That was Elizabeth Dickinson, Deputy Director for Latin America with Crisis Group. Women's soccer is growing more and more popular, and the pros are adding more games and more tournaments to their schedules in an effort to keep the momentum going. But the Women's Professional Soccer Players Union released a report today showing that more isn't always better for the athletes. The World's Bianca Hillier has the story.
Leeds corner. Oh, it's a good one. And it's 1-1. Cracking finish into the roof. In the past 5 years, the number of games has increased significantly, says Alex Colvin, the director of women's soccer at FIFPro, the union representing soccer players around the world.
For the first time ever, the top 15 players are over 50 games a season. And I actually looked back to our 21-22 report, and players who were in the top 15 were, you know, around 35 games a season. So you can see that there's been a steady increase of games.
That trend is set to continue. As just one example, FIFA has a new tournament, the Women's Club World Cup, set to launch in 2028. But of course, more games means more work and stress for the athletes. Today's FIFPro report shows how that expansion is impacting the players. Colvin worries that the growth is outpacing the resources.
The pace is rapid. I can understand it from FIFA's perspective. You know, they want the game to grow and they want to encourage growth. But I think there needs to be caution applied to doing things without analysis and consideration of the effects, you know, like there's cause and effect on everything.
The effect of the increased workload is evident in Aitana Bonmatí, who represents Spain on the international stage and plays for FC Barcelona.
Por dentro recibe Aitana Bonmatí.
Bonmatí was at the cornerstone of her club's and national team's success this past season, ultimately playing 60 games. According to the new FIFPro report, that's more than any other professional women's soccer player. But just a couple of weeks ago, Bonmatí fractured her leg during a training session. She'll be out of the game for 5 months. We'll never know for sure, but perhaps that wouldn't have happened if she played fewer games or if she had better recovery options in between games.
I think workload is just rising faster than maybe the systems are designed to protect those players.
Maitane Lopez is one of Bonmatí's teammates on the Spanish national team. The systems she'd like to see are the same ones that help the professional male soccer players get through more games, like personal nutritionists, ideal access to the gym and field, and of course, higher pay. To get some of that, Lopez left her Spanish club and switched over to the National Women's Soccer League in the U.S. But that has brought up another workload-related issue. Traveling cross-country on tight schedules in between games.
Travel-wise, it's insane. I've never experienced that many long trips with time change. And if you don't go 2 days in advance, you don't really fully adjust and adapt to the schedule. And it's crazy for your body. We are humans, we're not robots.
But at the same time that some players are experiencing too much time on the field, FIFPro says the majority of athletes aren't getting enough. Finding the right balance between too much and too little can be tricky, and FIFPro says they'll be prioritizing that next year when they meet with FIFA to set the international soccer schedule for 2029 to 2031. FIFA did not reply to my request for comment for this story. One solution FIFPro's Alex Colvin plans to bring up at the meeting is universal mandatory rest periods when players get a total break from their club and national team.
Having rest periods within the calendar that are like untouchable is really important. You know, it's not straightforward because obviously the US, for example, play at a different time of year.
The US Women's League plays from March to November. In Europe, women play from September to May. So coordinating a universal off period is difficult. The U.S. Men's Major League Soccer recently announced they'd switch to the global schedule, and Colvin wonders if the women's side would do the same.
Maybe the NWSL comes over to the like more European calendar. Who knows? That's not a question that I can answer.
In an email, the NWSL told me they are not planning to change their schedule right now, but they'll continue to analyze what's in the best interest of the league, the players, and the continued growth of the women's game. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Residents of one town in the UK say nearby landfills are causing health issues. A reporter tests the mud. That story is ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Across Europe, tens of thousands of aging landfills buried underground were recently identified as part of a major investigation by multiple news outlets, including Watershed Investigations in the UK. It's still not clear what is in the landfills or whether all of them have even been found, but there are growing concerns that they could be releasing toxic chemicals into the environment. Residents of Lancashire County in the UK are coming up against that reality in a very noticeable way. Watershed's Liana Hosia has their story.
In the seaside village of Thornton Cleveleys, retired science teacher Donna Davidson lives in a cosy bungalow in the shadow of nearby factories. She keeps her home spotless, but there's still an odour, not just in her house, in this village. The smell goes wherever the wind blows.
On a daily basis, people are waking up in their own beds and having to smell this horrible eggy smell that is so bad it's making you retch.
Davidson lives near two landfills. People here have been complaining of health issues that they say are related to the landfills. England's Environment Agency has been dismissing those concerns, saying that the gases coming from the landfills are within what the World Health Organization calls nuisance levels. But that's not very comforting for Davidson and her neighbours.
We're just getting told, oh, well, they're below the World Health Organization levels, but the human nose can smell the hydrogen sulfide, for example, which is one of the gases, at much lower levels.
The gas monitor has been put just over a kilometre from the Jameson Road landfill by the Environment Agency to measure emissions.
Well, they say that their monitoring station is fit for purpose. It's not. It's too far away from the landfill. The closer you are to a landfill, the higher the concentration of gases will be.
Foul gases are not the only worry when it comes to sites like these. There could be up to 500,000 landfills across the UK and Europe, most built before pollution controls were mandated. Many sit in flood-prone areas or on crumbling coastlines where waste could get released into the environment. Although modern sites are usually safe, there's growing concern that older landfills might be leaking toxic chemicals into the environment. That's what I've come to investigate, because a nearby chemical plant, once ICI, now AGC Chemicals, used the cancer-linked forever chemical PFOA until 2012. Records show it was dumped at the Jameson Road landfill, and locals say ICI used the hazardous waste tip next to it for decades.
I would like to see further sampling of the leachate.
Leachate. That's a term for liquids percolating inside a landfill.
We have a right to know, A, what's been buried there, and B, what the implications are for our health.
Closed landfills are rarely monitored, and even at active sites, PFAS is not usually tested. So I've put on my rubber boots and packed a kit from the lab to test for PFAS around the landfills. I'm being guided by an insider here who has requested anonymity for his protection. He walked me down a muddy path by the River Wyre. The land is waterlogged, bristling with reeds and scrubby grass. We were off the beaten track, but we could still see the factories. The closer we got to the landfill, the more I noticed it.
The closer I get to Jameson Road landfill, the stronger this smell of fetid onions or manure or sewage. Anyway, it's a bad smell.
I asked him what this place used to look like. He tells me there used to be lagoons filled with waste here, some full of acid and chemicals, dumped here by factories employees for decades.
And were they lined with...
No. No.
We arrive at our destination, an old discharge pipe coming out of the landfill, and I got out my testing kit.
I've got some plastic tubs, some glass tubs to take some soil samples and water samples.
It was slippery in the mud, and I had to move carefully to keep from falling. But finally, I got my samples, which I later sent to the lab for analysis.
Tell us what you found then, please, Liana.
David Megson is a forensic chemist, and I ran the lab results by him over the phone.
So the water by the ICI old landfill was 930 nanograms per litre.
I let him know the nanograms per litre of PFOA in the water near both landfills.
Wow, so both of those are in exceedance of environmental quality standards. So that's 5 to 10 times higher than what we'd hope for in those areas.
It's also 5 to 10 times higher than England's drinking water limit for PFOA, and more than 200 times the US standard. Of course, this isn't drinking water, but it is flowing into the environment.
So there's potential for that going out into the river. Yeah, it doesn't sound great.
I reached out to the landfill operator, Trans Waste Recycling and Aggregates Limited. In a statement, they said the part of the Jameson Road landfill I tested is closed and capped with an impermeable layer of clay, so they insist that the gas and leachate are fully contained. The company says that the river that flows through this area is contaminated and attributes high PFOA levels to that. As for the smells residents complain about, the company says, and I quote, "To claim that there have been odours for 18 months is not correct. We acknowledge that there have been occasional odours." NPL Group, which manages the site of the other landfill, declined to comment. Hi, Jess.
Hi, come in.
Hi, I'm Liana. Hi.
Hi, nice yes. to see you.
I'm sorry. Jess Brown lives less than a mile from the landfills with her young daughter and her elderly mother. Her daughter has asthma and has to use her inhaler more when the smell gets bad.
But it impacts my mum more because she has severe COPD. So when it happens, like, she's had a huge increase of chest infections, like, which that will mean, like, she can't leave the house. It makes her sick. And sometimes she just can't breathe and it's really terrifying.
I tell her that I've noticed that Trans Waste has sent people out to put soil on top of the old landfill to dampen the emissions. And I ask if that's helping at all.
Not at all. It's literally a mountain now. It has got bigger. Really, I think the only thing that would help is to close it down. It's 2025. We should not be living like this and be fighting for clean air just to breathe.
But with 4 out of 5 people in Britain living near a landfill, damage done in previous eras continues to haunt us.
For The World, I'm Liana Hosier in London.
Liana is with Watershed Investigations in the UK. Watershed teamed up with Investigate Europe to uncover that story with support from Journalism Fund Europe. It has been a year since the fall of the Assad regime in Syria. Since then, a new government has taken shape. Is it living up to people's hopes and expectations? That conversation with a Syrian historian is just ahead. You are listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This week is a major milestone for Syrians across the globe. 1 year since the stunning sequence of events that toppled the Assad regime last December, freeing the people of Syria from decades of repression under a brutal dictatorship. Historian Amr al-Azam, who left Syria in 2006, was on the first commercial flight into Syria after the fall of the regime, along with other Syrians making homecoming journeys of their own. We spoke to him just after he returned from a trip to Syria.
In the 10 days I spent in Syria, the one constant thing that I felt every single day from morning to night, from the minute I woke up to the minute I went to bed, and with everybody I spoke to, this overwhelming sense of relief.
Relief despite much uncertainty. Some pressing questions for Syria back then are clearer. The country has a government recognized as legitimate by the rest of the world and a leader who attended the United Nations General Assembly. But other questions remain. So we begin today by going back to Amr al-Azam. He teaches at Shawnee State University in Ohio, and he joins us from Doha. Welcome back, Amr. Great to talk with you.
Well, thank you.
So what does it feel like to hear that sound from the plane, to hear your own voice shortly after the fall of the Assad regime?
It still brings up strong feelings and strong emotions. Now, you could add to that, 1 year on, also the relief that as often with so many of these kinds of situations, when you have a rapid and sudden collapse of a long, deep, you sort of rooted, highly restrictive regime like the Assad regime suddenly falling apart and just disappearing, there was also the fear mixed in with the joy back then that the country will collapse and essentially lapse in back into fighting and conflict and even perhaps civil war. And it didn't happen.
There were so many questions about what the future would hold when we last spoke about a year ago. I want to replay some of those and then ask how things stand now.
What's our future going to look like? What kind of government are we going to have? What kind of rights are we going to have? What kind of representation are we going to have? But then there were other questions that were much more basic, like, when do you think we can expect to have normal electricity?
So I want to start with that question of electricity. Do people have greater access to basic things like reliable power?
That depends on where you live and how much money you have available to you. And for the vast majority of Syrians, I would say, who don't live in the middle of, let's say, a big city like Damascus, in the center of the city, for example, it's still very, very patchy. It's still very difficult for them to get access to those basic services, including electricity. Now, I hear in the last month or a half, things had gotten better, but that was also partly because they also increased the cost of electricity quite significantly, which again made it hard. So on the one hand, there was more power, more electricity available for longer hours put in the day in a city like Damascus. But at the same time, the cost of having access to that power also went up. So in the end, it's still very difficult. You know, 12 months on, are people finding it easier or better economically or just sort of getting along with their day-to-day affairs? I think, no, it's not. In some cases, it's gotten actually worse for them.
And the current administration is led by Ahmad al-Shara, who went from this role as this, you know, camo fatigue-wearing rebel to the suit and tie president of the country, who, as I said, has gone to the UN, has met with President Trump. Why do you think that there will be this inflection point soon about how he is handling the transition away from the regime and into something else in Syria?
If we were to put this on a, you know, success and failure balance, if you will, on the one hand, there's no doubt that the current administration led by Ahmad al-Shara has succeeded in on the external, arena, on the outside, you know, on the international stage. He's managed to rehabilitate Syria as a state, managed to gain international recognition for his government. All very, very important, and considering his own background, and most critically, has succeeded in rolling back some of the most strong and very restrictive sanctions that had been put in place on the Assad regime, and in fairly record time as well. But the fact they've managed to get all this moving is very important and very critical.
I sense a but here with the domestic situation.
Yes, exactly. But on the other hand, domestically, the scorecard is pretty low. They're not doing as well. In terms of security stability, we still have a long way to go. In terms of economic stability and security, there's still a long way to go. And most critically as well, in terms of the power sharing, in terms of engaging with the political sort of there is a fairly robust civil society that's quite active, and engaging with this civil society that has now started to emerge and to actually make its voice heard, all of these things have yet to be addressed. Transitional justice is another major area. They're making all the right noises, but in terms of actually translating those symbolic gestures into meaningful action on the ground, where people do start to see a return in terms of what it means for transitional, how to get justice, how to get grievances addressed, how to feel like they have a voice that can be heard, either through some sort of political representation or other. All of this remains very vague, very opaque and unclear.
What are you worried about as you look ahead?
I think in terms of concerns for the future, one of the things that I and others are looking at is the coalition of forces that came together to topple the regime 12 months ago and succeeded. You know, 1 year on, they're looking at themselves and considering what they got in return. Did they get their share of the spoils, if you will, if you consider toppling the regime as the main issue? So are they getting their share of the either access to the power, positions of power, or the wealth that comes with being in charge? And I don't think they feel they are. And that is, and that's causing significant stress, I think, within these groups. Today, you know, most power is concentrated amongst either the small handful of his relatives and immediate confidants, and those that he and his close entourage trust, and most of the other, you know, groups and entities have been left out. They're not getting their share, and they feel, and that, I think, is going to eventually boil over.
How would you characterize your level of optimism about the future for Syria now compared to a year ago?
I think a year ago when we talked, I said I was very cautiously optimistic. I think I still remain very cautiously optimistic. I would say that, however, I would add that if some of these, I mean, the stresses within, you know, the street and everyday people on their lives, and the fact that their lives have not improved and in some ways have actually deteriorated, their daily lives are, you know, their access to services, etc. And in terms of the factions that came together to topple the regime, feel that they're now they feel that they have not got a fair share of the spoils of victory, let's call it, and have started to air their grievances more and more loudly, make me are major causes for concern in the future.
Historian Amr Al-Azam joined me today from Doha. He is a professor of history at Shawnee State University in Ohio. Well, we're checking in on news from the Middle East. It has been a year since one of Gaza's most prominent doctors, Hussam Abu Sufia, was sent to prison in Israel. He's still being held without being charged, the World's Shirin Jafari reports.
The moments before Dr. Abu Sufia surrendered was captured on a video posted to his Instagram account. Filmed from inside the hospital, the footage shows an Israeli tank outside the gates. For weeks, the Israeli army had ordered the staff at the Kamal Adwan Hospital to evacuate, claiming that it served as a command center for Hamas and that the doctors and nurses were, quote, terrorists. But this was the last functioning healthcare facility in northern Gaza, and Abu Sufia refused to leave his patients.
Our Sofia gave regular video updates from the besieged hospital. Sometimes the bombings were so close, he would have to pause. He looked shaken, but he quickly collected himself and continued describing the dire situation. He talked of the lack of basic medical equipment, no power, the constant attacks that killed some of his colleagues. By this time, the doctor in northern Gaza was getting global attention. News programs covered his updates. The New York Times published his op-eds. One of them, from December 2nd last year, was headlined, "I am one of the last doctors in this hospital in Gaza. I am begging the world to help." But the attacks continued. At one point, Abu Safiya was injured by a drone, but he carried on with his work. Abu Safiya's family, his two sons and his wife, stayed in the hospital along with him. On October 25th last year, his 15-year-old son was killed by an Israeli drone strike. A devastated Abu Safiya led the funeral prayer for his son, buried his body on the hospital's grounds, and after that, he went back inside to care for his patients.
He knew exactly who he was and what his role was in the society. He was such a dedicated medical person, but also just a deep humanitarian at heart.
Joseph Balobo is the executive director of Med Global, a U.S.-based NGO that Abu Safiya worked for. He says he regularly asked Abu Safiya if he wanted to leave, but the doctor was committed to stay. On December 27th, Israeli tanks surrounded the hospital. Soldiers called on Abu Safiya to surrender. The Israeli military released footage of his arrest. Abu Safiya, in his white coat and surrounded by rubble, walked towards the tanks.
He was forced to come out of the hospital and into the tank and then subsequently detained.
The image of the doctor in his white coat, surrounded by rubble and Israeli tanks, went viral. Naji Abbas is the director of the prisoners and detainees at Physicians for Human Rights Israel. He says soon after that day, his organization asked the military about Abu Safiya's whereabouts.
Even though that his arrest was documented in video and on camera, they responded to us that they don't have any indication that he was arrested.
Abbas says only after the organization appealed to an Israeli court, the military admitted that he was detained. Later, the military said it arrested some 200 people at the hospital on that day, along with Abu Safiya. There is no official charge against Abu Safiya, but in a statement, the military accused him of, quote, being involved in terrorist activities and holding a rank in Hamas. It didn't provide any evidence. The Israeli military didn't respond to my questions about Abu Safiya, neither did the Israel Prison Service. Naji Abbas says a lawyer from his organization visited Abu Safiya in September.
And he complained that he's asking to meet a doctor for months, and he was refused. He complained that they are not getting enough food, that they are hungry every night.
Abbas says Abu Safiya is one of thousands of Palestinians held in Israeli detention without charge. Among them are healthcare workers, he says. And he sees this as part of a systematic destruction of the healthcare system in Gaza.
Because besides destroying the buildings of the facilities of the hospitals, when you arrest all of the staff of one hospital, you leave the hospital without the staff that can provide treatment.
Kamal Adwan Hospital stopped providing care after the arrests last December. It continues to be out of operation to this day. Salwa El Tibi, a colleague of Abu Safiya, tells me from Gaza that his patients miss him. And they are wondering why he was arrested.
Many of the people were very angry because he's a doctor, he was working there, and he's friendly, very friendly, so friendly with the patients.
She says she was hoping he would be released as part of the recent ceasefire agreement between Hamas and the Israeli government, mediated by the Trump administration. But that didn't happen. Joseph Balavo of Med Global returned from Gaza 2 weeks ago, and he says despite the ceasefire, the attacks continue.
We still are treating mass casualty events, including my Med Global colleague, a surgeon, held a young child, a young girl in her arms who died from in her arms from a bomb blast injury. This kind of thing is still happening now.
Roughly 400 people have been killed in Israeli attacks in Gaza since October, when the ceasefire came into effect, according to local health officials. I asked Belovo what he makes of the accusation that Dr. Abu Safia had connections to Hamas.
As far as we know, there's been absolutely no shred of evidence or connection whatsoever to anything that could be called a terrorist activity. I knew him personally. What he did was save lives and provide medical care to hundreds and hundreds, even thousands of people.
Care that is no longer available. It's been raining in Gaza in the past few days. Tents have been flooded and children are exposed to the cold. Perfect conditions for illnesses to spread, says Salwa El-Tibi. While many of Gaza's healthcare workers are dead, injured or in prison. For The World, I'm Shireen Jafari.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. An international sting known as Operation Thunder targeted wildlife traffickers, and it recovered nearly 30,000 live animals from illegal trade worldwide. That is the biggest haul of illegally traded animals ever to be intercepted and seized by authorities. Christian Plowman used to work for Interpol. Now he's with the International Fund for Animal Welfare's Wildlife Crime Department. He told us the large seizure tracks with the data he's been monitoring.
What some of your listeners might not realize is that the illegal wildlife trade internationally is worth some $32 billion
wow.
a year. That's incredible. It's the fourth most profitable organized crime in the world. So this is the figures are not surprising. What is surprising about the figures are the fact that it was 30,000 live animals that were seized. This means that the live pet trade, the illegal trade in live living creatures, has increased exponentially over the past few years.
Why is demand for these types of pets skyrocketing so much?
There are a multitude of reasons, but I think most topically is the exposure of the ownership of exotic pets online through social media and through e-commerce platforms.
Mm.
These animals are taken away from the wild and funneled into the live pet trade. They are sold to buyers who use the ease of trade on online platforms and the internet to be able to have these animals sent directly to their homes, for example. There's an incredible demand for live pets in Europe and the US and the Middle East. And criminal networks are going to exploit this trend, this desire to have exotic pets in our homes. And the fact that 30,000 live animals have been seized during this operation really does underline that the popularity of this type of trade.
So you could just go online and buy these illegally traded wild animals now, which is sending demand skyrocketing. Back in the day,
sure.
You might have had to know a guy or something.
Almost certainly, yeah. I mean, if you think about the way that internet infrastructure has developed, in the Western world and in the countries where lots of these exotic pets are sourced from, it's very, very easy to get online, to get in touch with people. Crime like this has no jurisdictional boundaries, no borders. It's very, very easy. It's conducted fairly overtly, I have to say. It's not like other types of illicit trade. It's done out in the open. And very often it's because people do not realize the damage that is being done to these animals and to their habitats. The fact that these animals are not designed to live in people's homes. They are designed to live in their own wild spaces where they belong.
What kind of animals are we talking here?
The whole gamut of species, to be honest with you. I think, exotic pets, generally, you would tend to think of things like big cats, so lions and tigers and things like that. However, I think in the recent Operation Thunder seizures, there was a very significant percentage of live animals seized that were birds. So we see species like the African grey parrot, which is protected under international law, being traded fairly overtly online. But there are also other species, you know, butterflies, spiders, centipedes, reptiles, snakes. You would be absolutely amazed. And as a former law enforcement officer, what I am always amazed by is the fact that there's such a significant criminal profit to be made on this trade. Mm. That's why it's worth, you know, $23 billion a year. There is significant profit to be made, unfortunately.
Where are most of these animals being captured?
Well, that would depend on the type of animal, obviously. So, for example, big cats will generally be coming from particular countries in Central and West Africa, and they will be removed from the wild by dedicated poachers who are part of an organised criminal network, and then shipped through very, very convoluted routes to the countries where the demand is the highest or countries where specific orders have been made. But I can't underline enough that this is a very, very significant global trade. If I was to draw a map of trade routes for all of the species that have been seized during Operation Thunder, for example, the map would be almost indecipherable. There would be, you know, routes going all over the place. Mm. It is a phenomenal trade. And that's testament to the success of this operation, the fact that the authorities were able to work together globally in multiple jurisdictions and be able to disrupt some of this criminal activity by seizing some of these animals.
How do you get a big cat from a country in Africa to, say, the US?
I mean, from a practical perspective, I can only imagine the difficulties. But what we find is the vast majority of movement from source countries to demand countries will be generally facilitated by paying corrupt officials, for example. That's a significant factor in the illicit trade. But also, this is where we see the convergence with other crime, like human trafficking, firearms trafficking, and drugs trafficking. Mm. They are all absolutely connected.
Catching traffickers in action is one thing, but, you know, of course, it would be better for the animals if they were not trafficked in the first place. Is that harder to make happen?
It can be, but there's a lot of work that we undertake on the ground. We work really hard with local communities, for example, to explore different ways of making money, to raise awareness about the broader nature of the illegal wildlife trade, and to make sure that those communities and those protected areas are not exploited by groups of organized criminals, which is, you know, effectively what happens in the illegal wildlife trade at the moment.
Christian Plowman is a program manager in wildlife cybercrime at the International Fund for Animal Welfare. We leave you today with something a bit more serene, especially as end-of-year busyness is ramping up for many of us. A piece from Iceland that's calming and feels kind of wintry to me. It's the work of composer and instrumentalist Gabriel Olofs. He is just 27 and was only 14 when he wrote a song that got him his first record deal. This song, The Lily, is from his album Solan Islandus. Music from Icelandic composer Gabriel Olofs brings us to the end of our show this Friday. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and check out our newest videos on YouTube. We are at The World News GBH. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Have a wonderful weekend and come back again on Monday.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. and by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.